about last night or today, things you've been doing the past week that you forgot about, that you remembered? I got a few minutes. Any movies?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm watching it. The reason why I met At wanted to know if he knew Hunter Thompson, because I'm looking at a couple of movies about Thompson. He was a pretty seminal figure, and I've never heard you mention him. And he seems like I'm wondering why he got overlooked.
No, he's there. I never met him, but when I met Walter in 79 and went out to his place in Aspen in 1980, which was Hunter Thompson's near the end of his peak period. The movie about him came out a little after that. But, you know, he was a heavy in the 70s.
Well, there were two movies. There was the Where Buffaloes Roam.
Right.
And then Leaving Fear and Loathing.
Right. I don't think I saw When Buffaloes Roam. I only saw Fear and Loathing, I think.
Yeah.
But any with Nicolas Cage or something?
No, well, Johnny Depp and...
Johnny Depp, right. But here's the thing. So I go out to see Walter in Aspen, Colorado, and he informed me that Hunter Thompson lives just down the street, you know, not too far away,
mm-hmm.
a mile or two. And he and Walter tells me, so this is the first time I've met anybody who knew him. And Walter either tells me this then, or one day we drive by his place. And Walter says that Hunter is afraid of Walter. Won't relate to Walter.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't think that guy was so nuts. I didn't think he was afraid of anybody. I thought everybody was afraid of him.
That's what's interesting. Walter, you remember, Walter was big before Hunter. You know, I mean, he made the...
Well, he was never of the same stature as Hunter Thompson.
But here's what you don't understand. When the East Village Other was big in the mid-60s, was the novel. It was what everybody read. It was the... Tim Leary wanted to buy the paper. He wanted the charisma of it. And he offered Peggy, as you know, I've talked about this, Peggy Mellon, to Walter in exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, Walter was... got the... he changed the world to the degree one could in the media. He got the spotlight. Hunter is running around with Hell's Angels at that point doing a biography of them, or sociology study, or whatever he wrote. That his first book was on the Hell's Angels, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So in the mid-60s, he was hanging out with him. And, you know, Walter represents the peace and love thing, and that's going to flip into Altamont and anger and speed and fuck-up and anger and Hell's Angels. So that's the 70s scene, 70s mood. Hunter rides in on that, the manic post-60s guy dealing with the violence of the 70s.
Right. Oh,
totally opposite mood and fame image than Walter. Very interesting to find out they're near each other. Here's the cosmic synchronicity. And that Hunter won't relate to Walter. Walter, this is Walter's opinion, none of it's true, Walter says that he's afraid of Thompson. Thompson is afraid of him. And he said one time he went over to Thompson's house and he knocks on the door and his fucking bullets fly out. And he thought Thompson was just a stupid idiot, on drugs, stoned, and you wouldn't go around him because he'll shoot you and he won't even intend it. He's just whacked out in his drugs.
Right.
And doing what he's doing.
That's the image I had of him, but I'm looking at this documentary, and I'm telling you, every hip actor in Hollywood and half the politicians, well, not half the politicians, but many politicians, including presidential candidates, hung out with that guy.
That's right. He was the heavy. You know what he did? In the 70s, he's writing for Rolling Stone, and he's like the cultural truth detector. He's a journalist for Rolling Stone for many years, and he gets on the White House campaign election buses, and everybody liked his version because it was the closest to the quote truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you got charisma for that, and politicians were so desperate, they'd hang out with whoever had the charisma, no matter what they had done.
Mm.
That was the TV landscape effect.
Right.
You had to be near the media image guys that had charisma. If you were seen with them, then you're somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually was a hypocrite in the sense that they fed off him and he fed off them.
Right.
So, anyways, that's the McLuhan take. I mean, the Bob take. So, what are we saying here? So, yes, so Walter said that when, I think he said that, you know, he avoided Thompson because it was dangerous.
I think the thing
Walter
that...
Walter did not admire him. He thought he was an asshole.
Right. Yeah, I don't see what... I don't know. I have yet to discover why he became so popular among all the hipsters from Johnny Depp to Nick Nolte to, you know, every actor you can think.
No, that's because those guys worship the 60s.
Yeah.
And maybe they even worship the 70s. See, for the next generations, the 60s, 70s blur.
Yeah.
And they missed that. They thought that was a time of authentic rebellion. And so they went to the image. And those guys were phony. That's why I meet people like Gerd and Walter, and they tell you the hidden ground of these fuckers.
Right.
You know what I mean?
The thing I thought that maybe made Thompson noteworthy in terms of media ecology is the fact that he blurs the image between the objective journalist and the putting yourself in the story. He merges.
That was called new journalism.
Yeah.
That's Tom Wolfe and everybody. He created gonzo journalism, which was you don't sit in the middle of reality and fantasy. You get stoned and square it and hallucinate on it. That's
right. And put yourself in the middle of the story.
Yeah, you purposely.
He makes himself the hero of the story.
Yeah. His hallucination, the hero of the story.
Yeah.
And it's totally explainable. That's the beginning of the Android meme and the digital reality, where the analog media is shrinking. It's now two-way. You impose your own making fiction reality on it, and the drugs was the metaphor. He's totally a 70s guy, whereas Walter and Gerd are 60s guys.
Yeah. Well, what's two-way about the media in the 70s apart from, like, the remote control on your TV set?
No, the two-way in the 70s is the breakdown of one-way, three networks. You get cable TV, which begins to decentralize community and media imagery, and alternative media starts showing up, like video and community television.
Yeah.
And that decentralization leads to multi-consciousness, not a standard consensus thing.
Right.
And the way you interact with that in the 70s is you get on drugs and make your brain hallucinate. That's the you're responding to the image that's being sent to you by hallucinating back at it.
Right, but it's still one-way broadcasting cable TV.
Oh, yeah, still, but it's the beginning of the breakdown.
No.
Centralization. And then you have the answering machine come in there, and the video recorder. They start breaking it up. So when it breaks up and there's no standard consciousness, the archetype, or cliche, or stereotype, becomes one guy hallucinating on the old one-way 50s and 60s model. That's what he did.
Right.
And the 90s is people hallucinating through the internet on what's happening.
Right.
And that's why Stuart Brand said drugs would be replaced by computers. So did McLuhan say something a little better than that. But Thompson is in between. It's still one-way media, but people are beginning to feel that they're not controlled by it. They don't need to listen to the centralized 50s, 60s Orwellian story. And you get a guy who hallucinates on it. That's a perfect example.
Ginsberg and Burroughs are hallucinating on it in the 60s.
But they are trying to make a community based on that.
Well, not Burroughs, maybe Ginsberg.
Yeah, Ginsberg, trying to make a community based on an alternative hallucination. But the problem is that in the 70s, virtual reality has taken over. Media is the only reality, which means the incorporate materialization of the TV landscape. And so you hallucinate on that. You don't try to make a community.
Yeah, Thompson's one-man reality show.
The body issues are gone. You're not like that's what Woodstock was. The epitome of the chemical body finally having its last instant city.
Right.
And I have to say that is fucking amazing. I never knew that Gerd was the engineer of that fucking thing. So that's incredible.
Well, yeah. I was listening to that. What do you mean he was the engineer of Woodstock?
Intermedia was hired to organize the infrastructure, the building of the speakers.
Oh, wow.
And the toilets.
Huh.
The whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
The practical needs for having an electrified environment and what the chemical body needs, food and toilet, he did that.
Wow.
He engineered Woodstock. I mean,
that's cool.
That's no one ever fucking said that about him.
Here's something I learned I thought was interesting. You know why they held Woodstock in Woodstock?
Well, didn't we go into that?
No, I bet you don't know why.
No, it's the Woodstock. Gerd didn't totally agree with this. He says it was not the Woodstock Arts and Crafts Festival. That had been going on. Bob Fass talks about the Woodstock Arts and Crafts Festival going on for a few years.
Right.
And so if you're going to have a festival, you play off that, but you bring in rock and roll.
Yeah, but no, probably, I think the real reason they had Woodstock in Woodstock was because the guys who initially conceived and were promoting the Woodstock Festival were trying to get Dylan to come out of hibernation and play. And Dylan lived in Woodstock, so they said, well, we'll put it in Dylan's backyard. He'll have to come out and play. And he still wouldn't come out and play. He went and did the Isle of Wight. Isle of Wight.
Isle of Wight is 69.
Okay, well, he did.
You're right. No, you're right. He did that a couple weeks later.
He does that instead because he's not ready to expose himself to that large of an audience with, he's working on something that's,
Are you saying this is a theory or somebody said this?
No, somebody said this, and it was one of the guys who actually was involved in the promotion of the Woodstock Festival.
He said that was their founder's reason.
Yeah. They were trying to get him to come out of hibernation and play because he was the biggest thing going around and nobody could get him to do a concert. So, well, we'll do it in his backyard. He'll have to come out. And he still wouldn't come out.
Yeah, because they thought he was a chemical body and he'd respond to the chemical body audience. They didn't know that he was wrestling with the TV landscape and his own image and hiding from it, as he says in his own biography.
Right.
Autobiography. I mean, they didn't understand the media was a realer than the chemical body.
Yeah.
But that is a great, what a punchline. And people, they're not going to listen to the whole fucking thing. Even Mons, he doesn't find it exciting enough to listen to.
Yeah.
But if he realized, we should fucking...
Well, that's why I want you to do a recap of what you see are the highlights, a 20-minute condensation. That might get people to want to listen to the whole thing.
Yeah,
but if they don't, at least they'll get the gist of what the guy's about.
I'm going to say, put the headline, the man who engineered Woodstock.
Yeah.
He engineered it.
Yeah.
And the people think he meant he created, but he was part of the creation of it. He wasn't the originator. He wasn't one of those guys looking for Dylan.
Right.
That's the other thing. He wouldn't even care about Dylan.
I just can't believe he's so unassuming about his life, like it was no fucking big deal. Oh, man. God, I wished I'd lived 10% of the life this guy's had.
but the whole thing about Dylan, you heard me, he didn't even like Dylan. He would not be attracted to that reason.
Right.
He'd been jaded. He'd seen Dylan.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Could it be from his marijuana? Or no, Gerd is wrestling with the media. We're gonna bring this point out. He wrestles with the media. He studied McLuhan. He's detached from the media. Does media art, yet he's inside doing it. He has an ambivalent relationship to media. He has an ambivalent relationship to his own history.
Mm-hmm.
And his own life, and he probably privately, I think he's trying to be, I think he always was a modest guy, and that's why no one ever hoiked him up. He wasn't a Hunter Thompson or Jerry Rubin trying to get attention.
He wasn't an artist on a level that he got that kind of attention. He was a hidden ground.
He did get attention in the cover of Life magazine. Twice.
He was on the cover of Life?
Yeah, Usko was on the cover of Life. Now there's something. You're so unassuming, you didn't even get that in your head.
Right.
He was in Life magazine twice. I know he's on the cover once. He might have been on the cover twice. Usko, his group, that gang, Steve Durkee, now a Sufi monk, they were on the cover because they created the best interactive light media environment happening.
Cool.
Okay, so and then he became very famous, but he didn't like it. He did not have the personality deal. He was a genuine guy looking for a community or friends. He's like me.
Oh yeah, he didn't.
Gerd go together. We're nice people. We're not trying to fucking, turn ourselves into an image, and that becomes more important than our interacting with people.
Right.
That's why I can look like a megalomaniac.
Well, it's possible to separate those.
Yeah, follow what I'm saying. That's why I can look like a megalomaniac, because I know I'm not that. So I'll hype it up.
Yeah.
Good is not of that sensibility.
Yeah.
A little more cautious. But what were you going
to
say?
Well, it's possible to separate yourself out from your media image. You know,
what's your point?
Well, I'm just going to follow that by saying in some of these documentaries where they interview, like, Johnny Depp, he seems like an interesting guy on his own, apart from his media image, but then he has this huge media image, but he doesn't seem to be all caught up in being his media image. So you can, you know, you don't, I'm just saying, you know, GERD just wasn't comfortable.
Like I said, hold the thought. I want to deal with what you said so far. There's an important thing in there. The Generation X generation are not as involved in the one-way media. They are very detached about media and their own fame because it ain't that important anymore other than they all work in the media and they got to work to make their living. His detachment, he knows to be cool about that. Okay? He knows to pretend. But Gerd was back when the one-way media, when you were famous, it fucking meant something. You know, you were in the spotlight. Now it's so watered down that these kids can be independent of it and have a detached feeling because there's no public space for the media audience like there was back then.
Right.
You know, so let's remember the generational cycles here.
Right.
They're different environments. These kids are naturally... You know, Johnny Depp, he's probably a fucking idiot, private life, a coke addict, and beats up people and all the shit that they all do anyways. And they don't even care that they do that, and yet they know to be cool on TV. Because they actually practice for living in their media interviews and don't give a fuck about the chemical body and are crude privately with their chemical body.
Mm-hmm.
So Gert, you know...
Well, he's a family guy with kids, so we can't make that assumption about Depp, but, you know, anything's possible.
Look, how many families does he have, you know? These people are nuts, most of them, when you find out about them.
Well, Dennis Hopper was fucking nuts. Now, Gerthead was friendly with Dennis Hopper.
There's always been... Yeah, what's the point of that? There's always been nuts. But I'm saying that Dennis Hopper didn't know how to handle himself in his relation to the media image, and he disappeared for 20 years.
Yeah.
Well, maybe 15 years until Blue Velvet in 86. But these kids can't disappear. They keep working, even though they're nuts privately.
Right.
No, it's... I mean, you know, as Jerry Fialka said years ago, anybody in the rock and roll industry or rock or music industry is a junkie.
Oh, really?
90% of them are fucking junkies. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
He knows it because he's around it.
Yeah.
He was with the Zappa World. They're all junkies. Have you looked at this?
Well, they're not all dying young like they did in the 60s.
No, a lot of them die. There's millions of people, these kids die. You didn't, you know, there's River Phoenix. There's millions of them that have died.
Yeah.
I don't monitor it. You have to read Rolling Stone. But the, you can say more die now than then. But have you seen Amy Winehouse?
She's a total, she's, I don't know how she gets by from day to day. She's a...
What if she's faking that?
The junkie thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay, well, check. Anyways, I got the CD. Didn't know anything about her, so the DVD about her concert. It's called, it's interesting. It gives a bit of her history. A little documentary. I told you.
As a matter of fact, you can just tell from her body type. Do you know, when she started out her career, she was a portly woman, and now she looks like skinnier than Twiggy. I mean, she's emaciated.
I get it. How do you know about her?
She fucking won a major-ass Grammy, and her song was just a hoot. I mean, everybody fed off of it. Yeah, I ain't going to rehab because, you know, she was...
Scott, I only got a minute, so I'm trying to do this quickly. You listened to the radio, so you knew her song.
I think Michael Shields sent me something on her, so I started paying attention to her, and then she won the Grammys, and then I watched her on YouTube and started following up a little bit on her, yeah.
Okay, so you watched the Grammys?
I downloaded her performance from the Grammys on the internet, yeah.
But you did not watch the Grammys live and see that she won?
Yeah, I think I saw that part of it, you know.
Okay, yeah, you were monitoring the Android meme, the central part of the Android meme.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. So, you want me to call you in an hour or so, or are you going to disappear again?
No, I'll probably be up. I got Worcester up while you were doing GERD. I had you on speakerphone so I could, you know, do other stuff. I got the Worcester up.
Yeah, do you realize that they're doing... That look at the synchronicity. This is the Bob Theater. I knew he'd done the opera. I knew a little bit about it. I heard him being interviewed on it on Bob Fast, you know, 3-4 months ago. But hadn't started talking to Dave yet on this stuff. Did the March thing, but we're now talking. Two nights ago. Well, what is this, Monday? So Sunday we get Dave, the real history of LSD, and then the next day we interview the guy who's doing an opera on it.
Yeah, I know.
The two worlds don't meet.
Now I thought you met him at the meeting that what's his face was having. Mark Stallman. Didn't you meet him at Mark Stallman was having some kind of a...
No. Gerhard Stern, in the summer of 2000, I always monitored Bob Fass, turn it on, and Gerhard Stern is being interviewed.
Oh, okay.
I have tape. I have this on. I call in once they start taking calls. I say, Bob, who knew me, Bob Fass, he knew my album and all that. I said, Bob, you have someone on there that I've been looking for years.
Mm.
Gerhard? I go, yeah. So then Gerhard comes on, and we talk. I probably have that in my audio archives. We could put that on.
And that was your initial contact, and after that you traded information.
Okay. So we made contact on the radio. He knew that I was interesting, so we talked privately, you know, a day or so later. I got his number somehow or something, and then I invited him over to Mark Stallman's. We'd finished the Nonlinear Circle a couple months before, but I invited him over to Mark's because that was a calm place to meet. And so we spent. That's when I first met him. Me, Mark, and might have been someone else there, and Gerd. And then Gerd and I got very involved with each other, and did still do.
Oh, okay.
We became friends. So, and then I introduced him to Don Thiel, who was born within 12 hours of him.
Oh, wow.
And there were two different synchronicities there. Don Thiel came to City Island, and I got them together, and we taped it, and Gerd has the tape somewhere.
Oh, cool.
Videotape of the meeting of Don Thiel. And Gerd read Don Thiel's book and was amazed at that Marshall was a poet. He never thought of Marshall as a poet, but Thiel presented that way. And that's where Gerd is not sophisticated, the intellectual postmodern blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so he was blown away, but he didn't finish the book. It was probably too heavy for him.
Right.
But that was an important meeting, putting these two guys together. And then I found out they were born that day. I found out, you know, Don was born October 12th, 1928. Gerd was born 19... No, Gerd's the 12th, I think, and Don's the 13th, 1928. So they're born within 24 hours of each other. Gerd lives, born in Germany, but he moves to New York City and lives very close to where Don grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Don would be very interested in the art world and in a Forrest Gump of the art world.
Right.
We did not know. I don't think we knew that he was a Forrest Gump when I introduced the two of them. I'm not sure. I might have read the Bancroft thing by then.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure. But Don would have been fascinated by knowing more about Gerd. Because Don, in his way, was a Forrest Gump of academia. He knew everybody.
Right.
He interacted with everybody, especially in Canada. But I got to end there. I got to go. So I think we're creating, you know, look, this is incredible. The Worcester thing's incredible. The Gerd story is incredible. But never did I know, and it's not played up in Gerd's life, that he's the guy who's the key guy who engineered Woodstock. And we got some good stories from him about it.
Yeah, ask him if his name is, or his companies are in the credits at the end of the film. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, you can check it out, but it probably is.
Yeah.
Okay, man, so I might call you in an hour or so.
Okay.
Something else.
Okay.
Thanks for putting the Worcester up.
All right.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye.